Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Sloan. Ms. Schein. We didn't mean to upset you.
That's okay.
Try to make it an easy greeting, but.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. Glad to be in Chicago, kinda. This case deals, and if I may just briefly synopsize what the issues are, because I recognize the court has plenty of briefs on this. But this case deals with a publication called the Christian Freedom Chronicle, and an ad that was placed in it post the publication being out there. For people to join the Christian Freedom Foundation, which was a matrix of free electricity, and getting a free subscription for that membership. The contention of the ad was to provide this free electricity, and if you read the ads, they increasingly become more cautionary in terms of when or whether this electricity and this matrix will be available. It starts out, however, as just an ad of solicitation for subscriptions as well as a membership of this foundation. Having said
that, why do you suppose they got more cautious as they went on?
My suspicion would be that they were maybe receiving phone calls that people didn't understand what the limitations of it were, and that they were trying to protect that and using the right analysis and making it more cautionary for people who were reading it to understand that it may or may not be there. The witnesses themselves testified that they were aware of the cautionary language and had repeated it themselves. Only one person suggested the word Christian was tied to the matrix connection and that's why she thought it was good, but she didn't read the ad. That information came from her sister. So all of them testified that the ad was cautionary and they understood the cautionary language and actually repeated it during cross-examination. But what makes this become even more complicated than that is the juror bias question that came up at the early part of the trial. And that has been the first issue that we presented to the court. The juror came forward and said that he had a problem after the first day of trial in listening to the evidence and the first few witnesses and indicating that the Christian relationship was religious to him and that he specifically said, I just totally disagree with this. The court, in responding to that, made a statement to this is juror Probst, and I think that's how it's pronounced, made a statement to juror Probst about that the court interpreted the evidence to not be religiously related, and the word Christian was tangential to that. The problem was there was no actual voir dire of the juror in a format that I think was minimally required by the court. And I point to the court's own analysis of this in McClinton, this court's honored opinion in McClinton, where Justice Breyer was quoted as saying that a racial slur is not automatically rendered harmless simply because it is intended as benign. Well, racial and religious issues are the two most biased issues for jurors in terms of sitting in a trial, and are the constitutionally based concerns that individuals should have when getting a fair trial. So at the very least, some inquiry of the juror's state of mind should have been initiated. In this case, there was little or no inquiry to the juror's state of mind. Simple questions like, what did you hear that made you think it was religiously related?
Did the attorney complain about the lack of voir dire?
No, and that has been an interesting question, Your Honor.
It was an interesting question. I'm waiting for an interesting answer.
Well,
did Kay raise any beef?
I actually have one. I think the way the court styled the questioning or the directive to the juror did not leave it open for any further voir dire.
You know, if you're waiting for an opening to say something you're complaining about, you may wait a long time. My curiosity piques me, was there any objection made by counsel to the way this was handled or to the juror itself?
No, there was not.
Okay, that stopped. You can quit there as far as my question is concerned.
I want to know the court to know that I wasn't that attorney.
I recognize that immediately.
An objection should have been made. I do believe that would have been helpful, and certain voir dire should have been initiated or a request for additional voir dire.
Well, if you don't object to something, it isn't, on its face, it is not sufficient to drive them off the panel. Word Christian was thrown in by your client, not by anything the juror did. Just he gave him pause, but he said he was able to put it aside.
My concern is because it's a fundamental right in terms of an unbiased jury that this should have been reviewed. It should be reviewed with or without that in terms of what the court's obligation is. The court's statement, and I'll move on from that, is a state of mind that the judge had, not a state of mind that the juror had. And there wasn't even a question concerning, can you put this aside? can you put this aside and still continue to be unbiased in your interpretation of the evidence? And it's of concern because it happened after evidence had already been admitted. But if you look at it from just the purity of that issue, you have to also look at the secondary factor that comes into play on the sentencing feature. If the judge's statement is sufficient to keep, to eliminate the bias concern, and that Christianity or Christian relationships are not infectious to this case, then the question concerning the two-point enhancement for acting on behalf of a religious organization has to be further analyzed against that backdrop. The word Christian isn't always religious-based, and I think that's what's happened here, is that in the juror instruction, or the juror's concern, the word Christian connotated a church or faith-based connection. In the enhancement, acting on behalf of a religious organization, the end result is he receives an enhancement for the sentence because of the word Christian and its association with the two things that he was doing, which was the paper and the ad. And neither of those were per se Christian organizations pursuing Christian or faith-based initiatives. It really was a solicitation for an electrical matrix. It has nothing to do with the faith.
Is your Ms. Shine, you would equate it then to something like the American National Bank, American having nothing to do with,
America.
Particularly with the America, the country, having nothing to do with the bank.
Exactly. And I can't see that distinction, but if we're going to say that the judge was correct, and I don't disrespect the court's intent to try to cure this problem, I just don't think it was enough to get a clear indication of that juror's mind of what evidence he heard that made him think that. But then later on, it comes back to haunt the defendant in terms of the sentence he received because of the word Christian and because of the alleged tie to a religious organization. That was his very statement when he said, I just can't agree with that.
Well, but I appreciate, and I think that's a significant point to look at. That is the enhancement. But just to relate it back, or separate it from the juror issue, Juror Probst didn't seem to have any express reservation, post that initial inquiry, which was kind of open-ended by the judge. It did invite Juror Probst to respond, I think.
She didn't invite him to respond in any specific way. She didn't ask in
probing. Do you agree with that? She enunciated that it should have nothing to do with it. Do you agree with that? And he said yes.
Yes, that is what she said, but I don't think there's
you think of another way?
Probing questions. I appreciate that the court doesn't agree with me, but I think that there is some question here based on the way the McClinton decision reads that some probing questions.
If you had a beef about, or the trial lawyer had a beef about this, that was the time to speak up and say, Your Honor, get her out of here, get him out of here. He didn't.
I can't argue against that particular item, but I do say because it's a fundamental right, the court has the opportunity.
If it were obvious that this juror were absolutely unable to proceed based on what had gone on, I agree with you. But it is not obvious. It's subtle. And if he's concerned about the subtlety, that's the time to sound off. Make a joyous noise unto the Lord, as we say in a Christian, do good business.
Speaking of Christians, so no pun intended, yes, that's correct.
That's why I
don't
put it in.
The court, Your Honor, but I am saying because it's a fundamental right.
I intended the pun, by the way, but go ahead.
Because it's a fundamental right, I believe that this is stronger than simply saying that the attorney should have objected.
Well, you agree we have to look at this under plain error, though.
I regrettably do. But I think that we've reached that because it is that fundamental constitutional right to have an unbiased jury. The other two questions that I would briefly synopsize that I think the court should look into further is the other questions concerning the sentencing enhancement, which is where the focus of a lot of this case was. The loss factor on the 83 additional victims, the only thing we can ascertain from the numbers was that there was no minimization of that or no refund analysis to that number, which we believe should have changed the actual base offense level. So the question turns on whether the court actually analyzed that value in terms of some type of reasonable average for refunds that all these other victims might have received. And we think that it is a problem that the court had when it just agreed to the stipulation. Now, counsel did object to the analysis of the base offense level due to Apprendi, Booker, Blakely, et cetera, but he also did, though it wasn't clear enough, I would say, for some people to see, but I think in interpreting his comments, he did object in a legal perspective that this amount of money wasn't applicable because it wasn't identified with the additional refunds. So I believe that has to go back merely on the basis of the loss analysis not being reasonably defined for an average refund. And when I do an average refund for all of them, it comes out to be about $180. from all the ones who did get refunds. I took all those numbers, added them together, divided by 8, and gave an average refund. It was about $180. If you add that, multiply that times 83, you end up with about $14,000. It's difficult to determine if that was deducted because that was potential money that probably these 83 victims got back.
Did counsel stipulate to a loss figure of $19,000?
He stipulated it, but with objection. He went ahead and left it there. His objections are not confusing, but they are based on the fact that he felt that the jury itself should have made that decision, but he also made a legal objection to it, saying that those 83 victims shouldn't be calculated without something more. It's not quite as clear as I'd like it to be, any more so than the juror objection, but there's a little more of an objection there in counsel's statement. It is in the sentencing transcript, and it does. I don't want to spend time articulating it specifically, but it does appear there where he objects to that number. He's stipulating for purposes of sentencing, but not for purposes of arguing its impact on the actual future guideline analysis. The other two aspects of this case deal with the more than minimal planning and mass marketing. And in the mass marketing, I would say that the court, just to look at this one item in particular, is that the mass marketing was based on something that preexisted. He used the paper simply to put an ad in the paper to bolster subscriptions and this electrical matrix. The last revised ad was more cautionary, but the point was that the paper preexisted the ad. So I don't know how it becomes more than minimal planning just to place an ad, though the contents of the ad itself may constitute, in this court's mind, the more.
What was his relationship to that newspaper?
Well, he was the one who started the newspaper. He's the one who put it out there and it developed it. And he was trying to bolster subscriptions to the paper. And this was a method to do that. He was tying in this matrix analysis to more to free subscriptions, trying to increase his mailing list and so forth. And the final item of consequences is the more than minimal planning. And that just ties into whether or not you consider putting this ad in there in the format it was in and the continuing changes as more than minimal planning. Or, in my estimation, he was actually increasing his cautionary language in the ads as they progressed.
Yeah, but he was also stamping a fictitious name on a rubber stamp, or he wasn't. His assistant was.
That's correct. But I still don't know where that comes into more than minimal planning in relationship to just placing the ad in the paper to get the results he was looking for. I truly believe that this case has some significant issues as to sentencing, and I have a couple of seconds, and I would like to just address the sufficiency. I just think that the ads are tied, that the ads become increasingly cautionary, and that shows some intent to actually resolve his case using fair play and candid dealings. So in terms of my sufficiency argument, I ask the court to evaluate the increasing cautionary language of those ads in making that finding. But I believe that the juror bias and the issue on sentencing concerning the two-point enhancement for religious-based organization is in conflict. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Shine. Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Joe Vaughn. I'm the Assistant United States Attorney who handled the prosecution of Mr. Sloan in the district court. I'd like to first start out with the matters concerning juror probes. Under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, the district court had an obligation to protect Mr. Sloan from prejudice. And in this case, the prejudice was a partial juror in contravention of the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of an impartial jury. The standard of review is plain error, and the government would submit that Mr. Sloan has failed to establish that the district court's colloquy was so obviously deficient that it permitted a partial juror to remain in this case. I'd like to address a couple of the grounds that Mr. Sloan has advanced in furtherance of the argument that the colloquy was deficient. The first is that the court did not permit him to question the juror. That is simply not a fact. In fact, Mr. Sloan did not object to the colloquy. He didn't ask to question the juror. He didn't ask that the juror be removed. He didn't object to the juror's continued presence, and he did not move for a mistrial based on any alleged bias. The colloquy was not conducted through a leading question. The court simply stated its opinion that the issues of Christianity were tangentially related to the issue in the case and should not conflict with the juror's religious beliefs, and then asked the open-ended question, "Do you agree?" And the juror responded, "Yes." There was no ambiguity with his response. in response to the assertion, well, the court should have asked additional questions. The government would submit that based upon the juror's response, the juror was impartial, there was no reason to proceed with any further questions.
You would agree, though, that there is a leading aspect to the questioning and as well as a power relationship, that is the judge, setting the premise for the juror.
I would agree and then respond as follows, that there's no evidence in the record of any duress by the court. Now, there is obviously...
No, I didn't mean to suggest that either.
Sure. Yes, certainly. There is obviously a power differential between the district court and a citizen who has come in for jury duty. But in this case, Juror Probst was not afraid to speak out, that he'd already spoken out, and he told the court that...
How did he come to the attention of the judge?
Evidently, based upon the court's recitation during the lunch hour, which would have been following the conclusion of the jury selection, but before opening statement, evidently the juror contacted the court's courtroom deputy and made a statement that he was concerned about a conflict of interest based upon the use of the word Christian in the case and his role as a deacon in the church. Evidently, the deputy then conveyed that information back to the district court.
That was initiated by the juror himself.
That's my understanding, and I believe that's what the record would reflect. Additionally, Your Honor, the court at the beginning of the jury selection process told the jurors that if there's any matter that you wish to bring to my attention that you may not want to address in open court, we can do that matter at sidebar. And at least one juror had availed himself of that opportunity before the question, before we even got to juror probes. Regardless of whether we characterize the colloquy as a open-ended question, a statement, or a leading question, due process does not require that the district court follow a set procedure, and there's no particular formula by which the court needs to evaluate or examine a juror for prejudice. As far as the Sloan's argument that, well, you know, the judge's opinion that the issues of Christianity were tangential to the issues in the case was inaccurate because at the time of sentencing, there was an application of a sentencing provision for misrepresentation that Mr. Sloan was acting on behalf of a religious organization. Obviously, facts that are before a jury to decide a trial are quite different from facts that are before the court to decide its sentencing. The burden of proof is different, and there was no issue before the jury regarding a role of Christianity or a misrepresentation of acting on behalf of a religious organization. So I think that is a little bit of a misnomer. As far as juror probes' impartiality, the test is, can the juror lay aside the opinions and base the verdict on the evidence? Juror probes had been selected as an impartial jury, or as a juror, to sit on the jury, and based on his concerns that he brought to the courtroom deputy, the court's colloquy with him, and his response that he made, he continued to be impartial, and the defense has, or Mr. Sloan has failed to establish that colloquy constituted a plain error. As regards the sentencing issues with the loss, the government's position is that Mr. Sloan, in fact, stipulated to the loss figure. The only objection that was made to the loss calculation was what I have characterized as a Booker objection, and that is found on the sentencing transcript at pages 9 and 10, where the defense explained his objection as being that the facts that would support a loss computation had not been alleged in the indictment, had not been proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury had not returned a verdict on the loss pertaining to the 82 additional victims. The court overruled that objection. Mr. Sloan's counsel preserved that objection, never raised any issue regarding the sufficiency of the government's proof for the 82 additional victims, and then entered the stipulation.
Mr. Vaughn, can I take you back to
Certainly.
To the enhancement because of the alleged reliance on it being a Christian organization? Now, you advance the testimony of B. Miller?
That's correct.
Is that really the foundation of the government's position that the enhancement is justified?
Yes, it is. That
well, she didn't contribute any money to a Christian organization. She just wanted a deal on electricity, didn't she?
I think what her testimony was, the testimony was very brief on it. I think what she testified to was she had been at a party with her that her sister was hosting where this scheme or venture, whatever we want to characterize it, was being pitched.
I guess the government thinks it's a fraud, don't you?
The government's characterization, and I believe the jury would agree, where the fraud was being pitched, and Ms. Bay Miller's sister told her that this is a Christian, I think it was a Christian organization, I think this would be good for you, I think you'd like this. Ms. Bay Miller testified, I heard it was Christian, I figured it must be good.
Is that any different than saying buy American? You know, don't buy an auto not manufactured abroad? Or what is the difference?
I think it is different because when we just talk about America, I think we're able to see, well, okay, we all live here regardless of what our differences are.
There are good Americans and bad Americans, but if you're talking about Christianity, there is no bad Christian.
Well, Judge, and I realize, and I see the smile on your face there.
Yeah,
but
you do.
I think that
smirk almost, but go ahead.
Well, I think there are people out there, and you look at Ms. Who said,
yeah,
it's Christian, this has got to be good.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why that name Christian was used,
which is precisely the reason they used
it, for that purpose, that rather than saying this is the James L. Sloan Freedom Foundation, cough up $498.75, Christian to some people means this must be legitimate.
So she thought she was in some way, but she wasn't, that is Ms. B. Miller, she wasn't advancing some Christian cause, though, right? She just had some reliance on a name.
That's correct.
Unless you think all electricity comes from God, then, you know, you could take almost
the position. I don't think that the evidence would not support an argument that Ms. B. Miller thought by giving this money there was going to be some kind of reward
in the hereafter,
spiritual or salvation.
Well, what's the difference if it was called the B. Miller, and she felt comfortable because it had the same name as hers?
Well,
a good name.
Okay. If there was an enhancement that said if you misrepresent the fact that this is for a family organization or something, then maybe it would apply. But obviously, if it's just a generic name as compared to Christian, it's not a religious organization, and we're in a different ballpark.
By the way, what's an 8x8 matrix?
I have no idea. that was part of the, it was the explanation of whatever that is. I don't think anyone will ever know. Regarding the more than minimal planning enhancement, that guideline provision, which is 2F1.1B2A, the pre-sentence report provided for a two-level enhancement based on two grounds. One is more than minimal planning. The other is that the offense involved a scheme to defraud more than one victim. Mr. Sloan never objected to the enhancement based on the offense involving a scheme to defraud more than one victim. Therefore, regardless of what this court, if it even chooses to address as more than minimal planning, it's not going to alter or change the guideline range or the sentence in this case. Finally, regarding the provision for involving mass marketing, once again, there was only a Booker objection that was raised, that it hadn't been proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Sloan never challenged the sufficiency of the government's proof on that point, and he has failed to establish that the application of that provision was plain error in this case. All right, if the court court has no further questions, the government would stand on its brief and ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you.
Ms. Schein.
I'll be very brief. I just have two simple points. I recognize the conflict concerning this juror issue, but I do want to say that the case law itself, at the very least, suggests that a reaffirmation of the juror's mental state is important through the unbiased nature of the ability to go on and make a decision in an unbiased capacity. That
question
was never asked.
In a plain error setting, can we have perhaps greater reliance on the assessment of the experienced trial judge in reading, if you will, whatever response juror Probst gave?
I never disrespect the district court, but in this case, it just wasn't enough, and it because it's such a fundamental right to have an unbiased jury. And the final thing I'd like to make a point about is this matter of the faith-based, that the guideline says, acting on behalf of a religious organization, Ms. B. Miller's statement was, I did it because it sounded good. She didn't say just that it was a faith-based organization, and she said that she would do it because she wanted the subscription in the Matrix, not because it was faith-based. And there was nothing in there that suggested the ad relates to a faith-based condition of the Christian world.
Do you have any further insight into Judge Keeney's question about the Matrix?
No, sir. I tried to think it through, but I decided it wasn't important enough to worry about.
Well, thank you, Ms. Schein. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.